from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. 3 years after the months-long U.S. bombing campaign in the war that devastated the North African country, Libya remains volatile and racked with violence. The latest victim of the widespread intensive fighting was the top cop in the capital city of Tripoli, who was shot and killed Tuesday by unknown gunmen. Colonel Mohamed Souaisi was shot while leaving a meeting in Tajoura, a suburb in the east of the capital. Two of his colleagues were reportedly taken captive. The U.S. State Department's deputy spokesperson, Marie Harf, issued a statement at the beginning of her daily press briefing Tuesday.
We strongly condemn today's assassination of Tripoli's police chief, Colonel Mohamed Souaisi. We are deeply concerned by ongoing violence in Libya. Colonel Souaisi was widely seen as a committed public servant. His murder and the senseless acts of violence against other officials, activists, and citizens throughout Libya threatens to undermine the aspirations for which the Libyan people have sacrificed so much. As we've said many times, violence will not solve Libya's problems. We urge dialogue and compromise to build a free, prosperous, and democratic Libya.
The political jockeying over who will be Iraq's next prime minister continued Tuesday, with some in Washington raising concerns that the current prime minister, Nouri al-Maliki, may not leave office willingly in favor of a new prime minister designate. The current deputy parliament speaker, Haider al-Abadi, whose appointment is subject to approval by the parliament over the next month. State Department spokesperson Marie Harf was grilled again about the political situation in Iraq and the extent of the U.S. role in the behind-the-scenes maneuverings.
Yesterday, I had asked if the U.S. government had played any role whatsoever in the selection of Prime Minister Designate al-Abadi, and you very clearly said no. Have you seen today's Daily Beast story, which cites U.S. officials as saying that they had pushed for Maliki for days, weeks, and it suggests suggests that an effort to oust Maliki had been underway since June. Is there any truth to that report?
There's not. As I've said multiple times from this podium, this is up for the Iraqis to decide. Of course, we've had conversations with them as they've gone through this process, but quite frankly, for a number of years, not just in this Iraqi election, but in the last one, there were a number of rumors and conspiracy theories about the U.S. role. I would squarely put this report in that category. As I said yesterday, this was a decision for the Iraqis and solely for the Iraqis to decide.
According to the Daily Beast article she was asked about, the president instructed his diplomats in Washington and Baghdad to find an alternative to al-Maliki several months ago. The article said that since June, those diplomats have quietly supported replacing al-Maliki with a member of his own political party. On Sunday, that effort appeared to pay off when a majority of the parliament's Shiite coalition threw its weight behind al-Abadi, leading to the Iraqi president's designation. According to the article, one U.S. official told the Daily Beast, quote, "We have been working very quietly on the ground and sending messages to various parties that al-Abadi is a viable alternative," close quote. Tuesday, al-Maliki issued a stand-down order to the military with respect to the political wrestling in an apparent attempt to allay fears of a military coup, which were raised in Monday's State Department press conference, among other places. Press TV's Kovi Tavwe has more.
Iraq's incumbent Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has ordered security forces to stay out of the political crisis in the country. Maliki has also ordered the security forces to continue with their duties to defend the country. Iraq is in a political turmoil over who will form the next government. On Monday, President Fuad Masum asked Deputy Parliament Speaker Haider al-Abadi to form a new government. Al-Abadi was picked by Iraq's bloc of Shia parties, the National Alliance. However, Maliki's Dawa party has rejected the nomination. It says the State of the Law coalition holds the majority of seats in parliament and only accepts Maliki as the nominee for premier's post. In the meantime, al-Abadi says that Maliki is a key figure in Iraq's political process and has an essential role to confront terrorism.
Al-Maliki's announcement followed a call by the UN Secretary General for the military to stay out of the political process. Derek Mbatha reports from the United Nations.
The United Nations Secretary General has stressed the importance for the Iraqi forces not to interfere in the political process in the country. Ban Ki-moon spoke to reporters in New York on Tuesday on global issues of concern to the UN. He reiterated his message of welcoming the movement toward forming a new government in Iraq after the country's president asked the Deputy Speaker of Parliament to do so.
Prime Minister-designate Haider al-Abadi now has the important task of forming a broad-based government acceptable to all components of Iraqi society. It is imperative that the security forces refrain from intervening in the political process. The people of Iraq, all Iraqi people, need security, yet the poison of hatred and brutality is spreading. The so-called Islamic State, IS, is a threat to Iraq, Syria, and the region.
Derek Mbatha, United Nations.
The Secretary General also said he expects accountability for the loss of innocent lives and damage caused by Israeli shelling of UN facilities harboring civilians in Gaza. He also addressed the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, which has now claimed more than 1,000 lives. We will bring you more of the Secretary General's press conference later in this newscast. In Gaza, the most recent 72-hour ceasefire is still holding. However, in the West Bank, at least one Palestinian was seriously injured after Israeli military forces opened fire on protesters who, they said, threw stones and Molotov cocktails at their bus. We have this report from Press TV's Kobi Tavwe.
The Palestinian has been seriously injured in clashes with Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces say that they opened fire in response to Palestinians throwing stones and Molotov cocktails at their bus near Qalqilya. Tensions have been running high in the occupied West Bank since Israel began its offensive against Gaza more than a month ago. Palestinians in occupied West Bank cities have been holding angry protests in recent weeks, and Israeli forces have responded with a deadly crackdown. 22 people have been killed in the occupied West Bank since the beginning of Israel's war on Gaza.
Over the past week, many thousands around the world have gathered to protest Israel's bombardment of Gaza, which has resulted in nearly 2,000 deaths, including more than 400 children. Friday evening, a coalition of activist groups in New York held a solidarity symposium on Gaza. Among the many speakers was CPR's own Bernard White.
On Friday, August 8th, at the historic John Hendrick Clark House in Harlem, I attended a forum. The forum was titled The Real Truth About Israel's Invasion of Gaza. It was brought together by the Black Alliance for Progressive Media. The reason why it was brought together is because there's a lot of misinformation and disinformation about what is actually going on in Palestine, and the group thought it was necessary to try and bring some clarity to those issues. So one of the individuals that we had was former council member Charles Barron, who spoke extensively about the history of the development of Israel and how the Israeli lobby affected his running for Congress in East New York here in Brooklyn.
We'll bring you that presentation by former Black Panther Charles Barron, who is also a former New York City council member, in tomorrow's newscast. In Ukraine, it appears that a Russian humanitarian aid convoy sent from Moscow early Tuesday has forced the hand of the U.S. and its allies in Kiev. After Russia was told Friday by the U.S. permanent representative to the U.N. that any unauthorized entry of Russian humanitarian aid into Ukraine would be considered an invasion of Ukraine by the U.S., Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered the aid convoy to start the overnight trip to Ukraine. U.S. State Department spokesperson Marie Harf spelled out the terms of a deal that Moscow reached with Kiev and Washington Tuesday.
So Russia sent an aid convoy this morning bound for Ukraine. Is that something that you're supporting?
Well, we understand that talks are underway for Russia to deliver the aid to the Ukrainian border, where it would be transferred to the custody of the ICRC. Ukraine confirmed with us directly today its readiness to facilitate the arrival of the aid and arrange for its delivery to Luhansk, so long as the shipment is received at a border crossing point controlled by the Ukrainian government in Kharkiv. It passes appropriate customs clearances that the ICRC takes custody and responsibility for the delivery in Ukraine, and the Russian-backed separatists allow safe access for the delivery of the aid. We do support this proposal, as I just outlined it, and as the Ukrainian government confirmed with us, and call for its swift implementation. Russia has no right to move into Ukraine unilaterally, whether under the guise of humanitarian convoys or any other pretext, without Kiev's permission. So we have spoken to the Ukrainians today. They have a plan in place that they feel comfortable with. We feel comfortable with it as well. And now the Russians need to deliver. No pun intended.
The World Health Organization has given the green light to release experimental drugs to Ebola victims in West Africa without waiting for testing and approval. Patrick Maigwa filed this report from the UN.
The World Health Organization says it is ethical to offer untested drugs to patients infected with the Ebola virus. WHO says the large number of people affected by the Ebola outbreak in West Africa and the high death rate have prompted calls to use untested medical interventions to try and save the lives of patients and to curb the epidemic. A team of medical experts who have been meeting in Geneva, however, recommended that certain ethical criteria, including obtaining informed consent from patients and families, freedom of choice, confidentiality, and involvement of the community, must be applied before administering any untested medical interventions. The recommendations followed the recent treatment of two health workers who were infected with the Ebola virus with an experimental drug. There is a limited supply of the drug, and questions have been raised about who should receive the treatment. Dr. Marie-Paul Kinney is an Assistant Director General at the World Health Organization.
The fact that there is currently no registered drug for Ebola is a market failure. It's a market failure because this is typically a disease of poor people in poor countries where there is no market. There are some potential therapies and vaccines which look promising, but which have not yet been tested, or if they have, not thoroughly in clinical trials. Some of these have already been used, or others are currently considered for compassionate use. Because we know so little about safety and efficacy in humans, whenever these treatments are provided for what we call compassionate use, then there is a moral obligation to collect and share all data generated. One of the panelists pointed out that this is an opportunity to right a wrong of history.
The Ebola outbreak in West Africa has killed over 1,000 people in Guinea, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Nigeria. Patrick Maigwa, United Nations, Geneva.
The Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, heads UN efforts to defuse an unusually large number of simultaneous crises with fighting and dire humanitarian conditions in multiple countries, along with a record Ebola outbreak. He addressed some of these in a press conference Tuesday in New York.
The world continues to experience tumult and turmoil and several crises occurring at the same time. I'd like to say a few words about three of the emergencies. First, the situation in Iraq. During my visit to Baghdad and Erbil last month, I urged Iraqis to support the democratic process. I welcomed the movement toward the formation of a new government. Prime Minister-designate Haider al-Abadi now has the important task of forming a broad-based government acceptable to all components of Iraqi society. It is imperative that the security forces refrain from intervening in the political process. The people of Iraq and all of the Iraqi people need security, yet the poison of hatred and brutality is spreading. The so-called Islamic State, IS, is a threat to Iraq, Syria, and the region. I'm profoundly dismayed by its barbaric acts, including accounts of summary executions, boys forcibly taken from their homes to fight, girls abducted or trafficked as sex slaves. The plight of Yazidis and others on Mount Sinjar is especially harrowing. UN humanitarian personnel are in the area doing all what we can. Airdrops of food and water are reaching some of the trapped people. But the situation on the mountain is dire. And even when people manage to find a way out, they remain exposed to searing heat and perilous odyssey. I urge the international community to do even more to provide the protection they need. And I condemn in the strongest possible terms, the systemic persecution of individuals from minority population and those who refuse the extremist ideology of IS and associated armed groups. Let me now turn to the situation in Gaza. The most recent ceasefire brokered by Egypt appears to be holding. But that is not enough. I strongly hope that a durable ceasefire will be reached soon. We must use this cessation of hostilities to address urgent humanitarian needs. The toll of death and destruction is staggering. According to preliminary information, nearly 2,000 Palestinians have been killed, almost 75% of them civilians, including 459 children. There were more children killed in this Gaza conflict than in the previous two crises combined. More than 300,000 people are still sheltering in UNRWA schools, government and private schools, and other public facilities, or with host families. At least 100,000 people have had their homes destroyed or severely damaged. Most of Gaza's households have little or no water supply. Hospitals meant to cope with the disaster are themselves disaster zones. The new school year was scheduled to start in less than 2 weeks, but a great many of the buildings will not be ready or are totally unusable in their current state. The United Nations will work with regional and international actors to rebuild. But unless we address the underlying causes of the conflict, another round of violence and vengeance is almost guaranteed. Israel's duty to protect its citizens from rocket attacks by Hamas and other threats is beyond question. At the same time, the fighting has raised serious questions about Israel's respect for the principles of distinction and proportionality. Reports of military activity does not justify jeopardizing the lives and safety of many thousands of innocent civilians. I have called for an investigation into the repeated shelling of UN facilities harboring civilians. I expect accountability for the innocent lives lost and damage incurred. Ladies and gentlemen, finally, the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, which the World Health Organization has declared a public health emergency of international concern. WHO announced today that the death toll has surpassed 1,000. These steps are especially urgent. First, three steps are especially urgent. First, addressing the severe lack of capacity in the most severely affected countries. Guinea, Liberia, Sierra Leone have only recently returned to political stability following years of conflict that destroyed or disabled their health systems. I urge the international community to respond urgently to the shortage of doctors, nurses, and equipment, including protective clothing and isolation tents. We need all hands on deck. Second, coordinated international response is essential. I remain in close touch with Dr. Margaret Chan, Director General of WHO. In the days ahead, the UN system will further strengthen the way we are dealing with the outbreak. To that end, in close coordination with Dr. Margaret Chan of WHO, I have designated Dr. David Navarro as Senior United Nations System Coordinator for Ebola Virus Disease. Dr. Navarro will be responsible for ensuring that the United Nations system makes an effective and coordinated a contribution to the global effort to control the outbreak of Ebola. Third, we need to avoid panic and fear. Ebola can be prevented. With resources, knowledge, early action, and will, people can survive the disease. Ebola has been successfully brought under control elsewhere, and we can do it in here too. And I thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Caraman.
Thank you, Stefan. Thank you, Mr. Secretary General, on behalf of the UN Correspondents Association. Thank you for your briefing. This is Karaman Haliselik with Turkish Radio and Television. Mr. Secretary General, a few years ago, when during your first term, you told us that you would try to be the voice of the voiceless. But the recent, from what I hear from my own country, Turkey, from what I hear from my colleagues in Gaza and elsewhere, that they say that the UN has been ineffective dealing with the crisis in the Middle East. What would you like to tell them? Thank you.
It's not the question of effectiveness or efficiency of the United Nations or international community as a whole. It's the lack of will of the parties concerned. They have not been listening to the voices of international community and concerns raised by myself as a Secretary General and many world leaders in the region and around the world. They simply have not listened to those voices of reason, and they have not cared their own people. In the name of protecting their own people, they have been letting their people being killed by others. Is that what they have to do? And therefore, this is almost the last chance for them. We have a very limited time. The 72-hour humanitarian ceasefire will end sometime tomorrow. So without losing any time, they have to agree to a more durable and sustainable ceasefire. Then I think we are ready. As I said, we are ready to build. As I said, it's not guaranteed whether they will be able to agree by tomorrow. Then are they going to resume their fighting? International community is going to have a donor conference again on an emergency basis. Now we are going to rebuild. Are they going to let it destroy it again? And I said last Wednesday in the General Assembly, my own anger, that we have been building and they've been destroying, and we have been building and destroying and building, destroying. I thought that this should be the last chance. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary General. You mentioned the Islamic State militant group, which now controls a large swath of both Syria and Iraq. What do you believe should be done to restore the full sovereignty of both countries and to prevent the Islamic State group from carrying out its goal of establishing an Islamic caliphate?
Now, first of all, if we look at the root causes of this extremist or terrorist groups penetrating into society, is that the lack of inclusiveness and dialogue with all the groups of the people, religious or sectarian, whatever it may be. The leaders should have always embraced and resolve all the differences of opinions among or between sectarian or religious groups in an inclusive way, a mutually inclusive way. This has not happened in many, many areas, including Iraq. That's why they have been allowing the breeding ground of these elements to take root. So now, I really appreciate some countries like the United States and some European countries who have been really trying to help Iraqi government and Kurdish regional government to prevent the further spread of this. International community should act together. First of all, promote mutual understanding among and between different group of people, ethnically or religiously. There should be a full respect of this. And they try to listen very carefully and sincerely to the voices of the people. Now that this large swath of this territory has been occupied or affected by this IS, we are very much concerned. And at the same time, it's only the people, hundreds of thousands of people, they are suffering because of this fear and threat and also humanitarian, very dire humanitarian situation. We have very limited capacity at this time because of a very serious concern. I hope that international community should do all what we can, bringing out, allowing the trapped people in Sinjar mountain area. I hope those countries who have capacity to do all what can allow these people be rescued as soon as possible.
Thank you. Talal, last question.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary General. The President of Iraq has already selected Dr. Haider al-Abadi to form the next Iraqi government. What words would you have to ex-Prime Minister Nourin Maliki, who is hindering the formation of such government? And secondly, on Gaza, there's a Human Rights Council efforts to investigate what happened in Gaza and to an inquiry. Would you recommend the Security Council members to take into consideration the results of such inquiry, sir? Thank you.
First of all, as I said already yesterday, I commend the Iraqi President Fuad Masum for having nominated Dr. Haider al-Abadi in accordance with the Iraqi constitution with the formation of a new government. I encouraged Dr. al-Abadi, Prime Minister designate, to form a broad-based government acceptable to all components of Iraqi society in accordance with the constitutional time frame. I'm concerned that the heightened political tensions coupled with the current security threat of Islamic State could lead the country into even a deeper crisis. I strongly urge all political parties and their supporters to remain calm and respect the political process governed by the Constitution. The people of Iraq deserve to live in a safer and prosperous and secured society. This is what the United Nations and our team in UNAMI in Iraq is doing in close consultation with member states. And about the Security Council taking up this issue about the violation of human rights. I understand that there is some consultation among and between the members of the Security Council about the possibility of taking this issue. But let us see how this negotiation is going on in Cairo. At the same time, it would be important for Security Council when they agree on a ceasefire and durable ceasefire, then this should be strongly supported, endorsed by the Security Council, as they did in 2009 when they adopted Resolution 1860, which has provided a very broad and comprehensive framework of parties should do to maintain this sustainability of the ceasefire.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.